Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and evening, everyone. This is Carl from ISF and Student Legion, and we are here for our third episode in November. And with me tonight is my usual cast of cohorts. That would be Brian Wallinger. Say hello, Brian.
How's it going, everybody?
Oh, good. And, of course, my friend from Oklahoma City, that would be Patrick Crane. Greetings, Patrick.
Hello, hello. How's everybody doing?
We're doing fine, and I hope everyone that's listening is doing well and getting prepared for Thanksgiving and get all that food in you and then, like, die on the couch and watch TV and football. So that's usually the case. But we here at Deviant Legion want to basically celebrate in another way. And that would be by the wonderful, wonderful, watching wonderful films, which we call noir films. Now, we've already done the classic ones, which are from the 40s and 50s. We also have done the post-classic or neo-noirs. But this particular episode, we are going to focus on foreign noirs that are not English language. So I think I'll pass it over to Brian. What do you have for us, Brian?
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
No. Okay, no. I got five good ones. I'm about to lay it thick.
Good.
This was hard. This was hard decisions. It was very this was crucial, man. There's just so many of these and we don't have enough time to talk about each one, unfortunately, let alone see each one. But I'm going to start from my five. I'm going to start on five and go down to one, if that's cool.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so my first one of these is actually a recently released film. It came out in, let me just check my notes, 2020, last December, actually. And it's an Australian sort of mystery thriller directed by Robert Connolly, based off of a novel with the same title called The Dry by Jane Harper. And this film is dark. I mean, it takes place mostly in the daytime, but it's just, you got to put on like three Disney movies after you see this thing, man. It's a beast. So it stars Eric Bana, and he's plays this federal agent, and it's pretty procedural at first. You know, it appeared that it was like a by-the-numbers investigation, police talk, and all of that sort of thing. But Eric Bana's character has to go back to his hometown in Victoria, somewhere in like the country. Well, their version of it anyway, so like the outback, as it were. And you find out that his character was actually involved in another murder mystery 20 years before. So while he's solving this new murder, it's also prevalent to the original one, and he was a suspect in that. And there's all these realizations and these characters that are shady and they have things to hide and nobody is what they say they are. And there's a lot of back and forth scenes in the story that, you know, jump around, you know, between the present time and then, like, you know, to tie in the continuity and all that. And then when you get to the end and you reach the sort of resolution, man, it's just so heavy. And Eric Bana is very good here. It's kind of a slow burn. It's not particularly violent. It's just a lot of talking, a lot of pretty, you know, cinematography of Australia and you know, that kind of thing, the sky and the community and that kind of thing. But just very well done, very effective for what it is. And I just thought, would ask if you guys are familiar with it.
No, I don't know this one at all. Not at all.
I'm not familiar with this one either. I'm not familiar with this one either. Though it sounds very intriguing, and I love, you know, it sounds very kind of. I love stuff that's set in the Australian outback, and I love, you know, I love Australian films. So it sounds right up my alley. And I love
if you guys get a chance, definitely check it out. Like I said, it's brand new, relatively came out last year, sort of under the radar through IFC Films. But I just checked it out today. It's very, very good, especially if you like Eric Bana as an actor.
Well, that's definitely a plus in my book, for sure. Okay, so I think now we'll move on to Patrick. What you got for us?
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to move in my preference order as well. And like Brian said, this one, I think I really sweated this one more than I did the neo-noirs, and neo-noirs are more of my favorites. So this was a strange one. I felt really compelled to make some hard choices. I apologize in advance. My hillbilly neighbors have their dog outside and it's barking incessantly, and that may set my terrible dogs off. And so there may be a chain of events that I'm going to be powerless to control. So if my dogs go if they go nuts, I'll do my best to muddle through. But the first movie I've got on my list is it's called Death Whistles the Blues. And this is a Jess Franco movie from 1962. And this was a very interesting movie. I didn't know anything about it. And Severin just did a nice a twofer Blu-ray of Franco Noir. And they are two films from the 60s that Jess Franco did that are in the neo-noir style. And the first one was Death Whistles the Blues, and the other one was called Reefy in the City. And Death Whistles the Blues was really interesting because it comes soon after the awful Dr. Orloff, which is more or less the movie that puts Jess Franco on the map. But stylistically, it's kind of similar, but it's also very different. It's much more action-oriented. It's about a bunch of weapons smugglers there's a movement of weapons that goes wrong, and everybody involved is either killed or put in prison. And then, you know, 15 years later or whatever it is, the one that's supposedly dead comes back to haunt the people that were involved. And when I mean haunt them, I don't mean like as a specter, but as a real person. They thought he was dead and he's not dead. And there's a lot of twists and turns. But it was really a lot of fun, and it really shows for people that aren't, you know, familiar with the other kinds of movies that Jess Franco made. He made quite a bit different kinds of movies. He dabbled in all kinds of genres, and he really made them stylistically his. This is a really good example of what a good filmmaker he really was, and it's a very interesting-looking movie, and it really feels a lot like what Orson Welles' stuff felt like when he was working in Europe. And not surprisingly, this was the movie, and I think Reefy in the City were the movies that Orson Welles saw and really liked, and then hired Jess Franco to work on Chimes of Midnight. But this has some early Jess Franco stuff in it that you would see pop up throughout his career, sort of the ditzy female detective person who gets involved in a case, although it's sort of secondary here where it would become more of a convention in his later films. It's just beautifully shot. We got a great location. It's set in Jamaica. I don't know if it's actually shot in Jamaica. I don't think it is. I think it's shot in Spain. But it's just gorgeous to look at. It's got some really nicely staged fight scenes. I don't know if it's the first film that has his Al Pereira detective in it, but it is an Al Pereira movie, And that's a detective character that would pop up throughout the remainder of Jess Franco's films. In fact, his very last film is Al Pereira versus the Alligator Women, I believe. So that was a character. Here he is in 1962. And then he's a character throughout all of Jess Franco's filmography. So that's a nice through line. And if you have any interest in Jess Franco, or if you like these kinds of films, foreign noirs, that is a really sweet looking set that Severn put out. And it's got a really nice, hour long interview with Stephen Thrower, who is a, you know, Jess Franco expert and scholar. But Death Whistles the Blues was really great, and I was really surprised. I thought it was going to be sort of a toss-off film, but it turned out to be very stylish and just a lot of fun.
Now, that's one, Franco, I don't know. I know Rafifi in the City, but I don't know that one. So I got to check that one out. Brian, do you know that one at all?
I've heard of it, and it's been talked about, but I have never actually seen it, no.
One thing I do have to say about Jess Franco is just go ahead and watch almost anything he ever did. I mean, seriously, even his straight-to-video stuff, which isn't that good, is still really recognizable. And there's a reason that we love Jess Franco. And it's just like the man made films for no money and so much style. Seriously.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And just, yeah. You know, I would always say, you know, his stuff can be hard to get into if you start in the wrong place. But if you start in chronological order and go as much as you can in chronological order, it is a rewarding trip. It is just a fun filmography, and it's huge.
Well, that's my next question. Where would you start? Or where would you want to start if you were sort of discovering that?
I would tell anybody to start with The Awful Dr. Orloff, his first film. Or not, it's not his first film, but it's his, the movie that's really kind of credited as the first kind of Jess Franco movie. It's a semi-remake of Eyes Without a Face, which is a Georges Franju movie.
Right.
He remade that theme over and over again. And but that's where I would start. I would start with The Awful Dr. Orloff, and then I would just go in chronological order. But I think another one that you could just always put on is Vampire of Lesbos with Soledad Miranda from 1970. I think that one is one that you can kind of watch out of context.
If you want to go starting with his more stylistic horror films, absolutely Orloff. If you want to go into a sexploitation, Vampire of Lesbos, absolutely.
Oh, sex is always fun.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Now, moving on, I'm going to start. I have a love of snowbound films. And I definitely have a love for Nordic type of noir. And I actually have two of them on my list. But the first one I want to talk about is Manon Pateket, otherwise known as Man on the Roof. This came out in 1976. It is based on a novel by Per Wallu and Maj Strobel. And these are the two people that actually there was a movie in the 70s called The Laughing Policeman, which was also based on their novel. The novels that they did together, which I think is a total of six, the main character is Martin Beck. And Martin Beck is a police lieutenant who, in this case, there is a policeman, a detective, in the hospital who is brutally murdered, and that leads them on a case where why was he murdered, who's murdering them, and the other people, and why are they murdering cops, and then finally, why is there this man on the roof shooting everybody? And of course, that's why it's called Man on the Roof. This one, just to say it as bluntly as possible, is gritty as fuck. It seriously is. It is a brutal little film. The violence, they don't show the violence, but they show the aftermath of it. And it is it's not pleasant. It's really, really good. The actors, there's no names for our English people, English speaking people, but Carl Gustav Lindstedt stars as Martin Beck, and Thomas Helberg, Gunvald Larsen, and so on and so forth. But I will tell you this, the acting in this is stellar. You could actually find this on YouTube with the original Swedish dialogue and English subtitles. And if you have not seen this, I recommend this one highly. So do either of you two know this particular film?
Yeah, I watched it. You shared that link with us, and I watched it. This one was something else. I was that opening sequence was. I mean, I was not expecting that much blood to just pour out, and it was just this was a really great little film. It was funny because for the first, half of it, it's more like it's almost like Day of the Jackal or a procedural. And then, the last 40 minutes is this wild-ass movie that feels a little bit like The French Connection. It feels like an Italian Poliziotechi almost. It's pretty – I thought it was pretty brutal in the violence, because – some of that stuff was like that helicopter crash. I mean, it's wild.
Oh, yeah.
It was quite an experience. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I'm glad you recommended it. I had a lot of fun with it.
Well, the last 40 minutes, I should say, is when the sniper is on the roof and then all hell breaks loose. Seriously. All hell breaks loose. And there's a line. There's one, not Martin Beck, but his immediate underling. And the police commissioner is there, and he just, police commissioner is an absolute asshole. And he just looks at him and says, Heil Hitler. It's like, oh, my God. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Have you seen this one, Brian?
No, unfortunately, I did not get around to watching the link that you take me, and I apologize.
Don't worry about it. We're all busy. It's November where it's coming up on Thanksgiving. So we're all busy, absolutely. So anyway, it is a movie I recommend very highly. We'll get it back to you, Brian. What do you got for us?
Mm-hmm. So this movie, when I made it public, I guess, so to speak, on Facebook, whatever, that I was going to do this one, people were saying, that's not the war. That's not the war. That's what you do with Google. You look things up. And I made sure that I wasn't just going to botch this, unless I was absolutely sure. And I found like two or three-ish, four articles that say Army of Shadows is a wartime war film. It's like a crossover of noir and wartime. So Jean-Pierre Melville came out 1969, and it's sort of fictional based on reality, French resistance based on, Kessel, Joseph Kessel. The book, he wrote a book, and it's about his experiences. So the movie is kind of the real parts versus fictional. But this film is bleak, and it is beautifully shot by Space Now Today. Forgive me, those winter hours. Pierre Actually, he had two cinematographers, so Pierre Lacombe and Walter Wolfitz. And I think I'm saying that right. And it stars Lino Ventura, Simone Signoret, Paul Meurice, and Jean-Pierre Castle, and a few others. But a lot of his actors, Melville had used in some of his other films, like Les Samurai and that kind of thing. But this film is just about these, you know, it's 1942. The Germans have just taken Paris. So it's very cloak and dagger, very spy. You know, there's almost, it's another one of those films where there's no action. There's no, it's not like a, like a classic American World War II film, like something like A Bridge Too Far, where Robert Redford's going to paddle through the channel while being shot at by artillery and with all the guys in, you know, and it's all glorified and it's America and, you know, or that kind of thing. This is very like, there's almost no violence at all. The Nazis have full control of the situation, and these people are risking everything they have to, like, face this evil that is occupying their country. And no matter what they do or how well the plan or how far the distance, it's just like everywhere they go, there's the Nazis. There they are, and they know everything, and everybody's fucked, and there's just no happy ending. But it's very beautifully done, very beautifully acted, just the whole film. And when it came out, it didn't do so well because at that particular time, France was facing a, sort of an internal political conflict. So it wasn't really, you know, a big deal at the time until about 2006 with the re-release. And then it had met, you know, especially in the U.S., a lot of people grew to it. And then, of course, the rest is history on it. Now it's considered to be one of the greatest films ever made. But the way it's presented to me in the dialogue and the way it's shot, the way the film operates to me is what makes it a noir. Because are together in the daytime and then they operate at night through the shadows, hence the title of the movie. And, you know, with noir, there's always the shadows and the darkness and that kind of thing. So in my opinion, I think it's a noir. I could be wrong. What do you guys think?
Well, all I have to say is I worship at the altar of Lino Ventura, and anyone who doesn't is no longer my friend. I love him. I absolutely, and I have only seen this once. And I saw it many, many years ago. It has to be like about easily 30 years ago. And it just, absolutely just, still I can see certain tableaus from the film and certain scenes in my head. That's how powerful this film is. And again, I can't recommend it enough. And it's one that I do want to revisit now that we've discussed it here and you had listed it. I just haven't gotten to it in the last couple of weeks. But how about you, Patrick? How about you? What do you think of Army of Shadows?
Oh, Army of Shadows is probably Melville's masterpiece. And I would definitely say it's a noir film. I mean, these are characters that have to live by a criminal code. Even though what they're doing is for the good, they, like you said, they have to operate in the shadows. It's very, I think, very much in the noir tradition, and I love its fatalism. I love how bleak it is, and I, you know, it's the little thing, the thing at the end that trips up the Matilda character. That's very, you know, the sentimentality attached to that feels like a noir convention almost. So, you know, I think Army of Shadows is very much a wartime noir film, and Lino Ventura is amazing in it. The cinematography is gorgeous, and I think it really, the way it was treated and basically buried, I think had a great impact on Melville's career, and I think it's maybe one of the reasons that, you know, it's only now that we really talk about him as much as we do. It's only been, I mean, you know, when I was going to college, my friend and I talked about this all the time, how you know, it's nuts. We never heard about him talk about any kind of like French New Wave class or anything. They never really talked about Melville. It wasn't until, you know, Michael Mann became, you know, popular. Bob LaFleur, I think it got a release in the 80s. I think it's when it finally
got released in America. Yeah, it did. I saw Bob LaFleur in the city. It was like about 83, 84. Absolutely.
Right. So, you know, he didn't really come into the consciousness, the American consciousness, till kind of later. So, you know, we're just now getting to where we're celebrating him and his filmography and his body of work, because I know each one of us chose a Melville title for tonight. And so, you know, that kind of speaks for itself. But Army of Shadows, I think, and this is a man that made a lot of great films. Army of Shadows is his best film, I think.
I might disagree,
yeah, sure.
But it's right up there. I'll get to mine later.
Yeah, go
ahead, Brian.
There's one scene that I think will be with me the rest of my life, and I think you guys might know it, but it's the one where he thinks he's going to be shot in the lineup when the Germans tell him to run towards the back of the wall, and then he refuses to run, and then he runs anyway. Then you think, oh, great, everyone's just going to die. And then you see the rope calm down, and then you're like, grab that shit. You know, you're like, you just like, you wanted to just get out of that situation so bad, which he does, but then the movie still ultimately ends very depressingly. But that moment, because, you know, we've seen all these different kinds of war films like Schindler's List and, you know, lots of Nazi films, and we've all seen people get lined up and shot. But in my mind, I can't recall another film where someone was supposed to die and then they didn't. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
speaks
volumes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I remember that scene. Okay, we're going to go over to Patrick. What do you got for us, Patrick?
Well, I guess I'll go ahead and do my Melville title connected. So I chose Bob LaFleur from 1956, and the reason I chose this one is because I can tie it back to our previous episode in a couple ways. One, I talked about last week Hard Eight being heavily influenced by this movie, and in fact, when I watched it again. Yeah, all the pieces of Hard Eight are there, you know, with the aging gambler, with the sort of dumb kid that he's got at his side. He's got, you know, the hooker who may or may not have necessarily have a heart of gold. And you've got this criminal element who chips in to his dumb protege and the prostitute. But you know, Bob LaFleur is much less tragic, I think, in the long run, because of the central relationship between Bob, who is an old crook who's basically now just lives to gamble, and this police detective who he once saved in a gunfight, and so they have a friendly relationship that, going back to Michael Mann, as we were talking about earlier. Is very reminiscent of Heat, where there's a, you know, the cop and the criminal are good friends. And in fact, there's a whole scene where he knows that Bob is going to be heisting this or doing this casino heist. And he basically takes him out on a social call to tell him not to do it, which is very much like the diner scene in Heat, where these two characters just, they're basically two sides of the same coin, and they have a mutual respect for each other. But in Bob LaFleur, it's very sweet, and even though the ending does have certain aspects of tragedy to it, it sort of ends on a higher note and a lighter note. I love this movie. I love the interiors. They're very reminiscent of a movie that he makes later, White Samurai. They're very jazzy and poppy. He's got some very beautiful high contrast black and white photography. The camera work is very fluid, and as a matter of fact, I noticed this time around there's an early scene at a dice table where when he throws the dice, the camera does a very, very dynamic move that is basically cribbed in Hard Eight. So I just think this movie is a lot of fun. I think it's a really great film. It's his excuse me, it's Melville's first movie of its kind, crime film like this. I mean, he made a couple of things that have sort of crime adjacent elements to it, but this is his first crime film, and I can't help but think that it's a little bit inspired by a pick that we'll talk about later of mine. But this also, going back to the last podcast, ties into Neil Jordan, as Bob Le Flambeur was remade as The Good Thief, directed by Neil Jordan with Nick Nolte, which I have not seen.
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't seen that either. As I said, I saw this in New York, and I forget what theater it was, but I had a friend of mine who by the name of Jeff Lepsack, who loved Melville. And, like, drug me to it, and I didn't really know anything about it. And that was the first movie that really got me into French noir. And you talk about Heart Eight, which we talked about, and I also love that movie. No question that those two are connected. No doubt. And I love the acting in this and just the, you know, it's a noir, but it's more character-driven. And that's what I like, is the interplay of the characters. It's a wonderful film. Wonderful film. Brian, what do you think of this one?
Again, this is one, unfortunately, I haven't seen. I mean, I might have seen it. I just can't recall if I have. Also, when it comes to Melville, I'm not exactly a quintessential expert on him, but I do own My Samurai and now Army of Shadows, and I love his body of work that I have seen, so I think I will pursue it more fluidly when I get around to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're region free, Brian, the Studio Canal put out a really nice set of his movies over in the UK. So if you, like I said, if you have a region free setup, it's worth looking on Amazon UK for it, because it collects a great number of his movies, and it's a really good purchase.
Yeah, no, I do have a region free player actually, and I'll tell you the story of why I bought one at the end of this conversation.
Okay. Well, you know, I think it's time for the Melville triple play. We might as well do it. And I'm going to go with Les Samurai. And the first thing I need to say about this is a shout out to Troy Howarth. Troy was selling some things that he had duplicates of. And at that time, Les Samurai was out of print. And he says, oh, I got Les Samurai. And I'm like, no, you don't. I bought it immediately. When I saw Bob Le Flambeur, I immediately started looking at all the rep theaters in New York City to find other films of Melville. And I saw this, I believe, at the Thalia, and I fell in love with this movie. Even more so than Bob Le Flambeur. This has a little more action. It's a little more convoluted, and there's a lot of good stuff going on with this one. And basically the story is you've got Alain Delon, who plays a character, Jeff Costello, and he's a hitman who works under contract. He's hired to kill the owner of a club. And when he is murdered before he takes out the before he does it, he is, of course, accused of the murder, but he had an alibi. And then basically he finds that both the mob and everybody is after him, the police too, and he's got to figure out what happened. And it is, there are some great foot chases in this. There's wonderful, wonderful shots and action, and it just adds up to what I think is the perfect film. So Patrick, I know you love this movie too, so I'm going to just take this over to you. And what do you think of Last Samurai?
This movie is, if not for Army of Shadows, I'd probably say this is Melville's best film. So it's, I think, his second best film. And I agree with you. It's as perfect as it can be. I just love how it defines a certain kind of cool. I love, the minimalism of the Jeff Costello character. Again, back to Michael Mann, with the character of Frank in Thief. He's a man who says very little, but says what's on his mind. And is a consummate professional. And I love just the colors. It's a gorgeous movie, beautifully shot. I love how colorless his abode is, how drab it is. But then, you go into these nightclubs and it's just awash in pop color. And it's just a wonderful movie that's a great feast for the eyes and a great time capsule of its time. And it's just an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah, I would also say the character that, this sense of this loner who is very, very competent, I connected it to the Ryan O'Neill character in The Driver. And it's that that type of character says very little but knows what he's doing.
Yeah, and in fact, this movie is pretty much remade in a way by Jim Jarmusch in Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai. It's more or less the same movie.
Hey, sorry about that, guys.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that this movie... I agree with you that it reminds me of Ryan O'Neill's character in The Driver, the consummate professional, doesn't have a lot to say, doesn't have much of an identity, really. But like I said, this movie pretty much got remade by Jim Jarmusch with Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, with Forrest Whitaker playing the Alan Doolittle character.
Yeah, I love that movie, too. I have this thing for silent characters who know what the hell they're doing and nobody else does. Yeah, very much so. Brian, what do you think of Last Samurai?
It was a day one Blu-ray Criterion purchase for me when that has come out. So that was sort of my surface level introduction to Melville. And of course, I've seen the lead, what's his name, Alain... what's his name? Yeah, he was in he had a lot of American success later, but this film really propelled him, and it's very romantic. I think Kathy Rosie, I keep forgetting names. So many movies. Kathy Rosier, I think she's very lovely in the film, and I think that the ending with Jane, that character Jane, I just remember when he dies in the end and he's with the woman and they check the gun and the gun's empty and that whole thing. I think that it's sort of, it's a minimalist film like you guys said, but it's also very romantic too. It's like he's sort of impassive as a hitman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful film and recommend it highly. So, Brian, we're back to you. What do you got?
Okay, so this film was actually also my introduction to Akira Kurosawa, and I had seen this film before I saw Seven Samurai, believe that or not. But this movie came out right after World War II ended. So World War II ended in 1945, and this movie came out October 17th, 1949. So literally Japan as a country, as a nation, is still rebuilding and trying to just get through, almost being annihilated by the two bombs, and Kurosawa makes this film in Japan, and a lot of it takes place in the daytime, and the movie's called Stray Dog, and it stars Toshirô Mifune, who's also in a lot of his films, and Takashi Shimura, and it was actually the second film Kurosawa did in 49. I can't remember what the other one is, but this is one of the earliest Japanese films to be considered like a detective story, a buddy cop film, that kind of thing. And the story is that Toshirô Mifune plays this detective, and he is very swanky. He's very all business, very tough as nails kind of guy. And it takes place during a hot summer day, and his gun is stolen. And the criminal that has his gun is using it to commit robberies and I think a little bit of murder. So he's tracking him down. But while you're on this sort of rabbit hole journey, you see a lot of Japan itself in the background, actual locations, actual alleyways and people and sort of the rebuild of this country. You know, and the hope that this country has for itself. And I think that's very symbolically very powerful that he had made those creative decisions, that even though there's this story taking place, it's taking place in the midst of, you know, the sort of the fog clearing of, you know, being near obliterated, and then now there's pushing forward economically, and there's just a lot of hope, and there's a lot of livelihood. And there's this great scene particularly that takes place at a baseball game, and you see everybody as you would in our country just watching this baseball game and enjoying it. And just, you know, little things like that really stick out to me. And then when he finally squares off with the villain, it just becomes this very powerful breakdown between the two of them, and there's a lot of empathy there, I think, and just a lot of just sort of understanding of who the characters are and what their purpose is in the story, ultimately. What do you guys think?
Great film. Great film. Again, I haven't seen this in years, but Kurosawa, you can't go wrong with Kurosawa and his early films, which are noirs. I mean, let's face it, he was the first person to adapt James Cain. And the Japanese were the first to adapt James Cain to film. I can't remember the exact title. I hope maybe Patrick knows. But nonetheless, Toshirô Mifune, you can't do better than Toshirô Mifune. Period. And I must say, I got to say this. If you're a fan of Alain Delon and Toshirô Mifune, you've got to see Red Sun. And you throw in Charles Bronson in the mix. And it's wonderful.
Yes.
And that's all I have to say. So, Patrick, go ahead. What do you think of Stray Dog?
I love Stray Dog quite a bit. It's one of those, you know, early Kurosawa films where you start to get his sense of rhythm, which is really relaxed, and you marinate in his movies a lot. He likes to take his time in unfolding his film because he wants you to live amongst the details. And the thing about Stray Dog is that it's, I mean, other than, you know, William Friedkin's Sorcerer or Robert Aldrich's The Grissom Gang, it's probably the sweatiest movie that I've ever seen. It just is oppressively hot, and it really does lend to this atmosphere of desperation. There's early on, I mean, the movie takes a while even to get to the sort of the crimes that are being committed with this missing gun. It spends a lot of time with Toshirô Mifune going through the back alleys and these really seedy places just to find this gun, this which is, I'm thinking, is like a needle in the haystack. And it spends a lot of time tracking this gun down, and you get the sense of desperation that comes through in his character. And it sort of made me feel like kind of like Bringing the Head of Alfredo Garcia, where these quests become very much more than what their original purpose were, you know, to begin with. But I do love, like Brian said, this movie does get into the empathy where the cop finally kind of realizes kind of how desperate these characters are down here in the flotsam and the jetsam of society, and especially in post-war Japan. And so that brings a real human element to the film, even though his partner, you know, says, oh, you know, you'll forget about this as you go on, you'll mature and you won't care as much. I like that both sides of that are expressed, and they're both probably right. He probably will stop caring after a while, because I'm sure you become jaded, you know, in law enforcement after a while. But, you know, I do like that idealism is still represented.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. So, Brian, anything else about Stray Dog before we move on?
Well, if there's anybody listening that hasn't seen it, I definitely suggest it. To me, it's a near-perfect film, and definitely one of Kurosawa's best.
There you go. I would agree with that. So Patrick, we're on to you, sir. What do you got for us?
Well, I guess then I will go ahead and do my Kurosawa pick, and I chose 1963's High and Low. And I don't know if I know which one is based off the James Cain novel, actually, to tell you the truth. So I get a demerit for that, but I don't think it's High and Low. Because this is from 1963.
That might be,
yeah, right, because that would have been, you know, 40s, right? Whatever you're talking
right.
about would have been in the 40s. High and Low is a movie about a shoe executive played by Toshiro Mifune again, who is in a really difficult position at work. He's got these kinds of pressures, and all of a sudden, with all of his fortune on the line, with this very risky business move that he's attempting against his partners in the shoe company, his child is kidnapped and held for a ransom that will financially ruin him. But what happens is that you figure out it's not even his kid that's been kidnapped, it's his chauffeur's. So for the first about hour of this film, it's all almost like a stage play. It really doesn't leave Toshiro Mifune's living room. And then all these players are in there, and there's a moral quandary about, do I pay the ransom, do I not? I mean, what will this do? Because he is just literally, if he pays the ransom, he will go into financial collapse. And then the movie, you know, he ends up paying the ransom, and there's, you know, this gorgeous and exciting exchange for the kid for the money. And then the whole last hour and a half is about the cops. It becomes a procedural about tracking down the perpetrator and the money. And then it sort of becomes this whole other thing about where these cops who don't get paid anything are really looking for this, you know, guy's, this millionaire's fortune down here in the slums of I forget where this is set. But the great thing about this movie is that Toshiro Mifune's house is on this giant hill that looks down on everything, it seems. And so you can see it from almost like everywhere in the movie, and it just gives you this impression. This movie is a lot about class as much as it is a cop film or a thriller or a noir. This is a movie steeped in class, and, you know, again, Kurosawa liked to track the economic prosperity of Japan after the post-war period, and this is a movie where you have a great separation between the haves and have-nots. But I think High and Low is a really great, great film. Again, it's a long one. Like Stray Dog is a little over 2 hours. This one's 2 hours and 23 minutes. But you're never bored. It never drags. And I think it's one of Toshirô Mifune's greatest performances.
Unfortunately, I don't know this film, so I can't really say anything about it. I just wrote it down, so this is a blind spot for me. So I'll just take it over to Brian. Do you know High and Low, and what do you think of it?
I know of it and things about it, but no, I've never seen it. I do really want to. Patrick, I may be wrong, but isn't this considered by kids American breakthrough, kind of, like to audiences?
I don't know. I don't know where. I think the Seven Samurai did well here, didn't it? I'm not sure. I'm not real sure about his cultural or financial impact on America on American audiences. But I was going to say Seven Samurai is I think 1954 or something or 55. I think it would have probably been the thing that did big business for him first, I would guess.
Yeah. Also, the way you're describing the plot kind of sounds like Ron Howard's Ransom back in the 90s with Mel Gibson and Gary Sinise.
Yeah, it's a little bit, a little bit like that. I've only seen Ransom the one time. I saw it in the theaters. I don't remember a whole lot about it. I remember the trailer a whole lot, but I remember the movie being okay. I didn't dislike it. But yeah, it's a little bit like that.
Just the plot, rich guy, the kid, the cops, the money. I mean, I can see where the inspiration, just the way you're explaining it, the inspiration comes from.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll definitely check that out as well.
Well, okay, so I guess it's my turn. Go ahead, Patrick.
No, I was just going to say, to anybody out there that hasn't seen it, I think High and Low is one of Kurosawa's best films. So, I would highly recommend anybody out there who hasn't seen it, get to it.
Mm-hmm. So I think what we'll do is keep in Japan. I was going to first do a film called Investigation of a Citizen about Suspicion, and I watched it. To be honest, I didn't like it. And so I was thinking of another film. It happens, But then I was speaking to Steven, my former partner, and I was telling him, well, maybe we'll do the American Friend, but of course you're going to be picking that one. And then he says, oh, no, I got the perfect one for you. And he was right. And it was actually, I'm a huge fan of Beat Takeshi. I think Sonatine is just one of the most perfect films ever. But he does a lot of gangster films. But he did a film previous to that in 1987. And it's on the Arrow channel. And if you do not have the Arrow channel, I recommend it highly. $5.99 a month, and the amount of film and it was on the Arrow channel. And I watched this afternoon Violent Cop. Let me tell you something. Boy, is this one dark as fuck. Seriously, Beat Takeshi plays this cop, and the whole movie starts out with these kids beating up this homeless guy. And then the next scene is Beat Takeshi going into one of the kids' house who he saw did it and then slapping the shit out of him. Let me tell you something. People get slapped in this movie. I think I counted at least 125 slaps. And kicks and shit. Unfortunately, he has a sister who is somewhat mentally deficient. And he also finds out that the main drug cartel is being run by the cops. not exactly a good time for Beat. And what happens to his sister is disgusting. It has one of the most downbeat endings you've ever seen. It reminds me a lot of a film that I mentioned last week, To Live and Die in L.A. It's just, you know, depressing. But the funny thing about Takeshi, and I really noticed this, is that his beats, his structure and his flow is very unusual. There are shots in this movie where the actor doesn't move for 20 seconds, and it's almost like a still photograph. And it's like you want to see him thinking. And this is what he does, and he does a lot of this. And so it's very unusual as far as flow is concerned. But when it gets violent, oh, my God, it gets violent. And it's really something. Now, I know you messaged me, like, where do I see this, Patrick? So do you know Violent Cop, and what do you think of that film?
No, I don't know Violent Cop, and I'm only casually familiar with Beat Takeshi's work. I did see Solatine years and years ago, and I don't – is it Solatine or Sonatine? I can't remember.
Sonatine.
But I saw Sonatine. That one. Sonatine, okay. I don't remember anything about it, and I also saw his Zatoichi remake and really thought that was fun. And I remember seeing Brother in the theater, his one American film, which I dug the hell out of. But there was a period where I was being introduced to him and Takashi Miike at the same time from a friend who admires them both quite a bit. And I got into them on, like, you know, surface level and then never really went back. But I did like the movies that I saw, and you are piquing my interest because, you know, I'm all for dark and bleak as fuck is my brand. So, you know, you're pushing the Arrow channel on me. I mean, we're going to be probably doing an app realignment in our home in the next couple of months because, you know, we're finding that we pay for these things that we don't even watch. And so, you know, $5 a month, that doesn't sound bad, even though I give Arrow quite a bit of my money over the years, just buying up their physical media stuff. But, you know, $5 a month, I could maybe save some money in the long run.
Excuse me. Brian, what do you think? Do you know this film?
I know the director. I've never seen Violent Cop, but like Patrick said, I have seen Brother, and I think I've seen another one somewhere at one time or another, but no, I've never seen Violent Cop.
Well, you know, when I was speaking to Steven, I said, is it even really a noir? It's a Takeshi film, and that's the one thing about Beat Takeshi, is that one thing you have to remember is that he started out as a comedian. Okay, and then suddenly he's doing these gangster movies that are just bleak. And
it happens.
It feels different. It does feel different. And that's why I pointed out the shots that are stationary and things like that. The flow is different. And so it's almost like it's not real. The way that he shoots and the lighting and everything, it's almost like you're in a different reality. And I really like that. So I cannot I have to just recommend anything that the man has done. He's got better films. He's got worse films. But there isn't a movie that he's done that isn't entertaining and isn't worthwhile watching, seriously. So I recommend his work highly. So I guess at this point we're back to you, Brian. What do you got?
Well, I know you wanted to do this one, but I stole it from you. Please forgive me. But 1977's neo-noir, The American Friend, directed by Wim Wenders, who's actually one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And how I got into his work, real quick, I'll just try to tell the story real fast. I was doing Cole at the Museum of Moving Image, excuse me. And I was with a colleague, and we watched Wim Wenders' release of his Blu-ray, Wings of Desire. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with that movie that time I saw it. I didn't know anything about the film, never seen it before, didn't know anything. And I saw this beautiful black and white movie with Bruno Ganz and, of course, Peter Falk, and just wanted to pursue this man's work, Wim Wenders. So I had gotten the full cut of Until the End of the World, that kind of thing, and I love the man's work. Anyway, so we get to The American Friend, and this was also a film that I knew nothing about, just total blind bias. I saw Dennis Hopper, Bruno Ganz, Neil Noir, and I was just like, yeah, I'm going to watch this and already know that it's going to be good before I watch this because it's 70s Dennis Hopper, and that, to me, is when he was at his peak creatively until, you know, of course, maybe Blue Velvet and River's Edge and that kind of thing. But here, yeah, this film, which has a lot of different languages in it, it's German and there's American and I think a bit of French. And I also believe it's the first time that the character Tom Ripley is portrayed on film. I'm not sure if that's true, but I know it's based on the book Ripley's Game.
It goes back to Purple Moon, I think, is the first one. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but Purple Moon, the Renee film, 1968, I think.
You're correct.
But, okay, go ahead.
It was, and I think Purple Moon is Alain Delon too, isn't it? I think he plays Tom Ripley.
It is Delon. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead, Brian. Oh, sorry to interrupt.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm glad this was a light mistake and not the one I made last week with Steven Soderbergh and Renee Klum. I will never forgive myself for that.
Oh, but, please, don't.
Anyway, so yeah, Dennis Hopper's Tom Ripley, and Bruno Ganz is this sort of peculiar fellow, to say the least, probably one of the greatest performances he's done, and he's done a lot, did a lot. So Dennis Hopper is this wealthy guy, lives in Germany, and he is this schemy man involved with art. And he goes to auctions, and there's a lot of forgery with paintings, and he has an accomplice and this and that and the other thing. And he meets Bruno Ganz, and then he sort of befriends him, kind of befriends him enough for like a means to an end, and basically uses him as like an assassin and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of moments that I would say are Hitchcockian-esque, not completely, but there's some moments where there definitely is a lot of suspense. And again, another one of those films that's very carefully crafted, very delicate, beautifully shot by Robbie Mueller. And just absolutely fantastic film for its time. And yeah, that's basically what I have to say on that.
Well, it's one of my favorite films. I also am a huge Wim Wenders fan. One of my top five films of all time is Paris, Texas. I love Alice in the Cities, and he does a lot with journeys and that sort of thing. And he does a lot with that. He has a wonderful documentary on Pina Bausch called Pina, and just a great, great filmmaker. This is probably my favorite Ripley movie. It is, period. We were talking about this last night, actually. It was mentioned during the John Allen Simon podcast that we did yesterday. Because he did Out of the Blue with Dennis Hopper. And this is, he's just so good in this. And Bruno Ganz, you basically see him in German films. And, of course, he also played Hitler in the one film a couple of years ago, about 10 years ago, and was up for it. Yeah, thank you. But just a great actor. This is wonderful. And I just got to give a bow down to a cameo by Sam Fuller in this, too. You know, you put Sam Fuller in a movie, I love the man, seriously. So anyway, I love the film. I think this is a great film. I do believe it's the best of the Ripley's, and you can argue that with me, and we'll take it over to Patrick and see what he thinks of Der Amerikanische Freund.
This movie, yeah, I think this movie is absolutely a knockout. Not only Sam Fuller, but, you know, also casting Nicholas Ray. I love how there's these filmmakers that are cast in this movie. It's a weird one, too. It's just a really strange film. I came to Wim Wenders by way of Paris, Texas. That's where I first encountered his work, and I fell in love with that movie hard. And then I saw Wind of Desire, I saw this, and I saw the theatrical cut of Until the End of the World, and I liked it quite a bit. I did not like Far Away So Close, the sequel to Wings of Desire, but I did love his documentary on the Buena Vista Social Club, the Ry Cooter Cuban group. What I love about Wim Wenders, and I'll talk about this next pick too, he was the most influenced by American iconography of all the new wave German filmmakers. And that pops up a lot in his movies. And in this one, I love how in Dennis Hopper's house, you know, he's got this jukebox that's covered, and he's got that Canada Dry pool light. And I love those little touches. He, and the cowboy hat and the American music in the movie, of course, then there's the king. But, you know, he has a very odd, endearing love for American landscapes and American signage and iconography. And that comes through in Paris, Texas, which shoots America like it's a foreign country. And to him it is, even though I think he was living in America at that time. But I thought it was a terrific film. I thought Dennis Hopper was out of this world. And like you said, Brian, I've never seen Bruno Ganz any better. He was really astounding. And I generally like him fine. I never think of him giving performances that are, you know, dynamic or, you know, complicated or anything. But he, I mean, like really, really excellent in this book, in a very understated kind of way. But I just loved its pace. I loved how but I cannot say enough about Dennis Hopper's performance. That is worth seeing it for. That's worth seeing it. But also Robbie Mueller's cinematography is incredible.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think in the first scene of the movie when you see Dennis Hopper's character, I think he is wearing the cowboy hat. So, I mean, right from the start, Dennis Hopper is just Dennis Hopper the whole time. And the real victim of the movie is Bruno Ganz. But because he plays like this terminally ill guy, he's dying. And I think he does die at the end of the movie anyway. But he just has to go through this horrible ordeal with Hopper. And Hopper's just this sly, you know how he was back then, just that sly, cool, smooth-talking man with the little thin tie, like the cowboy, what do you call that, necktie thing, and the hat and the blazer. And it's just so out of place. Yeah, thank you. He's just totally that guy. And there's just such a sophistication that comes with him in that. And I love the damn thing, you know?
I agreed.
So, yeah.
So it's over to you, Patrick. What you got for us?
Well, now staying on our German theme, I'm glad it worked out this way. Even though this really isn't my second, what I would say is my second favorite of this batch, but it just worked out this way, and it's not that I don't like this movie at all. I do actually like this movie quite a bit. It is 1970's Gods of the Plague, directed by Rainer Werner Fassbinder, who is my favorite of the German New Wave directors. In this one is really an unusual movie because, you know, Fassbinder comes from a sort of a theater background, and his first few films are very theatrical. The way they're blocked, staged, they're very minimalist. They're very much in the vein of, say, early Jim Jarmusch, I would say, is very similar. But Gods of the Plague is, I think, his third film, and it's a sequel to his debut, which was called Love is Colder Than Death. But Gods of the Plague has different actors, but they're playing the same characters. But it's about a man who's released from prison, and he, you know, wanders about on, you know, in the free world, and he's completely detached and bored until his old buddy, whose name is Gunther, comes into his life and starts hanging around with this old girlfriend named Joe, and they form a strange trio, and there's, you know, they plan to knock off a grocery store. This man was sent to prison from the first film committing a robbery, and he's getting out of prison at the beginning of this movie. It's a little odd. Like most of Fassbinder's early films, again, they're very experimental. He was very influenced by the French New Wave, and that's kind of apparent. But what I do dig about this one is this is where you start to see him using a lot of mobile cameras and dolly shots that I think are very influential on the visual look of Martin Scorsese's work, and in terms of the dynamic aspect of it and the fluidity of it. And in fact, Fassbinder's cinematographer, not for this movie, but for later films, it was Michael Ballhaus, who went on to be Scorsese's cinematographer for a few films, including Goodfellas. But this movie, you get to see a lot of, like I said, a lot of mobile camera work, a lot of gorgeous black and white cinematography. Fassbinder was one of those guys that was just as good in color as he was in black and white. And I would also say that he was also one of the great needle drop directors of all time. His choices of music he's one of my top five as far as those directors are concerned. He could use pop music like Paul Thomas Anderson or Martin Scorsese uses it. And that's apparent in this movie. Shows up in this movie in a really, great opening sequence. But if you don't know this movie, it's worth seeking out if you're interested in Fassbinder. He's another one of those guys. I think that you should go through his stuff in chronological order because, like we were talking about Jess Franco earlier, Fassbinder has a very large body of work that he cranked out in like maybe 14 years, 15 years. He was not on the scene for very long. I think he was around from like 1968 to 83 is when he passed away, or 82. And in that time, he made like 40 movies. And you would think that would mean that they were shoddy or cheap, but all of his stuff is quality. He's one of the masters of cinema, and he's one of my absolute favorite filmmakers. And Gods of the Plague, I think, is a very good movie. It's not one of his best movies, but I think it's a very good early Fassbinder film.
Yeah, this is one I don't know at all. I mean, I know some Fassbinder, not as much as I should, like The Double Life of Veronique and a couple others, but yeah, this one sounds really good. Brian, do you know anything about this film?
No, I don't. And the only movie I've seen of his, sad to say, Fury to the Soul. That's the only movie of his that I've seen. I really like that one, but I just haven't really gone through the rest or any others.
Yeah, as far as Fassbender, for me, it's World on a Wire, which is one of his few science fiction films, which I just friggin' love. And I said, this one I don't know.
Yeah. World on a Wire, I actually kind of halfway thought about using. It's kind of noirish. It's, you know, in its own special way. But, yeah, that one is absolutely terrific.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And I did mention The Double Life of Veronique, which I also think is outstanding. Yeah, he's a filmmaker I should get a little more into. It's funny you mentioned Needle Drops because I think Ben Benders is one of the best at that too, who we were talking about previously.
Definitely he is, yeah. Definitely.
You know, okay, so I guess it's my turn. And we're going to go back to the north. And we're going to do a film that I love, and I'm kind of slightly cheating. Because the movie is in English, but it is directed by Billy August, who is a Danish director. And it is a really, really interesting noir, mystery noir. It's called Smell the Scent of Snow. And it stars Julia Ormond. And in her building, a young boy has jumped off the top of her building. And, of course, it's set in Copenhagen at this point. And, of course, it's snowing, but she knows snow. And she knows that he was forced off the building. And so there's all these different things that go on. And she gets hooked up with Gabriel Byrne, who may or may not be an ally. There is a doctor that's involved with this, which is played by Richard Harris. And finally, what happens is that there's this mystery that goes back to the boy's heritage and parentage in Greenland. So Julia Ormond hops on a boat and hides and that to go to Greenland to figure out what's going on. And then when you get to Greenland, oh boy, there's a turn in this one. And it is, and I know a lot of people didn't like the ending of this, including Ebert and Siskel and Ebert. I disagree. I think this is one of the great endings, and I love it to death. And I love this movie. I think it is Julia Ormond's best thing she ever did. And I just really like this. And this is based on a Danish novel, Brocken Smell a Sense of Snow, but in Danish. It's just really, really good. And the cast is amazing. You've got Gabriel Byrne, you've got Jim Broadbent, you've got Tom Wilkinson, you got Richard Harris, you got Robert Loggia, and it's Vanessa Redgrave. The cast is just to die for. And as I said, it's got a real, real twist at the end. I love it. I think it's great. And I'll take it to Patrick to see what he thinks of Smell a Sense of Snow.
Unfortunately, I have not seen this movie, but yeah, you've sold me on it. And then when you got to Robert Loggia, you double sold me on it. I'll see anything with Robert Loggia in it. So it sounds very intriguing and it sounds like something that I would love, but I have not seen it. But I remember when it came out, but I just never did see it. And I didn't have the time to get around to it this time around, but I will, I have it marked down as a must see.
Yeah.
Robert Loggia.
Well, Loggia actually plays her father in this. And he's very good. Everybody in this is just tremendous. Do you know this film, Brian?
No, I don't, but I am a fan of Gabriel Byrne. I mean, I love some films I've seen him in. And, of course, the cast itself, as you've said and as Patrick has said, that sounds pretty solid.
Yeah, and all I will say about the ending, it changes the whole film genre. That's all I'll say.
One more time, what's it called? One more time.
Smilla's Sense of Snow. And that's S-M-I-L-L-A apostrophe S.
Yeah, I'll have to write that down.
Yeah. So anyway, Brian, I think we're near the end of our choices here. So what do you have for us?
So this is my number one film. And here's a story about the Blu-ray player. Okay, so I had bought this film from Italy because at the time there wasn't an American release, but there is now, ironically. But so I'm a huge Chad Nicholson fan, as I'm pretty sure most cinephiles who are like us probably are. Like, Carl, you grew up in the 70s, Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
Same as you. So you guys remember a lot of his stuff and all of that. But I took a deep dive on the man because I had seen, like, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest at a young age, and I loved that. And I, of course, had seen The Shining, and I've seen, you know, As Good As It Gets and The Departed, and just the guy is great, even when the film was not great. And then, of course, I saw The Last Detail, which I think is a brilliant film. But this film that I'm going to talk about is the reason why I needed a Blu-ray player, because, like I said, there wasn't a regular Blu-ray, but now there is. And that's Michelangelo Antonioni's 1975 film, The Passenger. And this film really, really cooks. I mean, I don't know if a lot of people have seen this film. I think maybe a lot of people have, but I feel like today's audiences are just have. This film has totally gotten lost in the mix, because when I see a lot of conversations about Jack Nicholson, this film never gets talked about, and not even just for a Jack Nicholson film. For me personally, in my opinion, I think it's one of the most unique films ever done, and I haven't seen anything else like it specifically or remotely. I mean, but so basically, Antonioni got a three-picture deal with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer through a producer, forget his name. But the two films were Blow Up and Zabriskie Point, and I have only seen Blow Up. I've never seen Zabriskie Point, so I can't speak on that one. And this film, I think, competed at Cannes that year. I have to check on that. But Antonioni wrote this thing, and, man, it is something else. So Jack Nicholson plays this TV journalist, right? He's making a documentary, and it's about post-colonial Africa. So he's in the Sahara, and he's talking to these rebels about a civil war that's happening. And you can't find any people to interview for some reason. The story just is written that way, and he gets lost in the desert. I think his car breaks down, his rover breaks down, so he's already like stressed the hell out and what have you. So he goes back to the hotel. Eventually he does walk and gets back, and it's the following day. The adjacent room has another guy in it, this Englishman that Nicholson's character spoke to, I think briefly, but not really that much. So it's like sort of a Chekhov's gun thing. But this guy dies of an unknown cause. And Jack Nicholson only knows that this guy is dead at this moment. So he digs into this guy's life based on the possessions and things that are in his hotel room. And he steals his identity because he finds out this man is a gun runner, an international arms dealer, and he's funneling weapons to the Civil War, to the rebels that, ironically, Jack Nicholson was going to interview, but no one knows what this guy looks like. So Jack Nicholson becomes this man. And Maria Schneider's in it, who's amazing. Her debut was The Last Tango in Paris. She was 19 when she made that, Bertolucci, Brando, another great Italian-American film that I adore, despite the controversy of that, but I don't want to go into. But anyway, so they go on this journey together, and there's sort of a romance between them, and Jack Nicholson is struggling to provide the weapons, and he's making this money, but he just becomes a wanted criminal. The police are after him. The rebels are after him. He's constantly on the run, this and that. And it just, it's fantastic. And again, no one really talks about Jack Nicholson's performance in it. It's sort of a film that people were aware of at the time, that got recognition of the time. But in retrospect, when people talk about Nicholson, it's always Cuckoo's Nest or The Shining or you know, something to that regard, which is quite a shame because this film is fantastic. It takes course over Italy, Spain, France. There's like three or four different languages that are in it. And the cinematography by Luciano Tavoli, I can't think of any other films he's done, but the color palettes are so beautiful. There's a scene that stands out where I think Jack Nicholson's in this gondola and there's like this water coming down and he raises his arms up and the camera's behind him. And it just looks like he's in touch spiritually with himself, and it becomes like this sort of almost fever dream-like shot, and he's just like vibing off himself, and it's just, it's incredible stuff. And it's sad that, you know, again, in my opinion, it's a film that everyone kind of just forgot about.
I remember seeing this on one of the pay channels, and I mean, it's been 40 years since I've seen this, easy. So I can't really say too much about it, but I do remember liking the film a lot. The one thing that I do remember is that the pacing, it's not slow, you know, and it doesn't feel slow, but it is leisurely. And so the tension builds throughout the film very, very incrementally. And that I really liked about it. Antonioni is a very fine director. He's never been one of my favorites by any means. But to be honest, this and Blow Up are probably his best films. But I do have a real soft spot for Zabriskie Point. As much of a misfire as it is, I really do have a wonderful soft spot for that. So that's all I really have to say about it. Patrick, we'll kick it over to you. What do you think?
Oh, Carl, please, please have me on about a Zabriskie Point discussion. I absolutely love that movie, and I could talk about that movie for fucking hours. I just love Zabriskie Point. And that was my introduction to Antonioni, was Zabriskie Point. And this movie is co-written by Mark Pepley, whose sister wrote Zabriskie Point, Claire Pepley. She wrote it with Antonioni and Sam Shepard, of all people. But, the Passenger was the third picture in his three-picture deal, and it sort of just got, shuffled off when it got released because Zabriskie Point was such a disaster on all fronts, critically and financially. And so, you know, he was red hot with Blow Up. And he'd already been red hot with La Ventura. That's the movie that sort of changed everything for Antonioni. And Blow Up was such a giant sensation that there was such high hopes. Oh, he was going to make this American Hippie movie. And it just, I mean, it was a day late and a dollar short. By the time it came out, I mean, the hippie movement was mostly all gone. And it was just, I mean, it's a disaster. But I love it. And, like, we can talk about that at another time. But The Passenger comes out, 5 years later. And I don't think MGM did a whole lot to support it. I probably think at that point MGM was in some kind of studio flux, because I think that's around the same time Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett Miller Kid disaster, which happened because of a studio change, I think, or studio shift in the politics, I think. So that could have also contributed to why The Passenger sort of been buried over the years. I love it. I would say that it's glacially paced. I'd say it's slow. But there's nothing wrong with that. I love slow movies. And I'm going to tell you what, I was as hungover as I've ever been in my life on Sunday, and nothing went down better than watching The Passenger. That movie, it's never loud. It just, it's engrossing. Like Antonioni's movies, they sort of lull you into this, you know, sense of, you sort of like drifting along, and you know, the plot of the movie isn't even all that important. It's like La Ventura. I mean, the whole thing about that movie is a woman goes missing, and by the end of the movie, nobody gives a shit about her. I mean, we've moved on from that somehow. We drift away from the central point. And all of his movies are about, you know, characters that are stricken with ennui and boredom, and they're all looking for themselves, and they're looking for, you know, they don't fit anywhere. They're trying to solve some kind of opaque mystery that's about themselves. The movie that I initially chose for tonight is one of my picks, A Story of a Love Affair, is his debut, and it kind of is like, it's a film noirish mystery that sort of kind of goes off in a different direction. Now, Antonioni was sort of his own beast. He's the only one of all a lot of these directors who doesn't feel like he's really influenced by American noir or American movies, for that matter. He's his own kind of, he created his own kind of film language. And I think The Passenger is very much in that canon. I think it's one of his best films. I think Jack Nicholson is fantastic in it. The cinematography, as you say, is just gorgeous. But, you know, it really was sort of the end for him. I think he made a couple more movies. He made that Identification. I think it's called Identification of a Woman with Tomas Milan. And then he made one other movie, and then that was pretty much it for him. You know, I mean, Zabriskie Point, I think, really did damage to his career. And I think because The Passenger just didn't get that that kind of support from the studio that maybe it should have. But then again, I don't know how much of a mass audience would have attached themselves to The Passenger. But, you know, it certainly was not supported by the studio. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that it's been mostly forgotten. It came – I know that it was restored and re-released into theaters, you know, in the art house circuit in 2004 in conjunction with the DVD release, because it had been – it was on VHS, and then after, you know, that, it sort of disappeared. But there was a kind of a semi-big, you know, re-release of it in 2004, I think it was. And it kind of came – so that's when it started to come back into the consciousness. So it may be, you know, another 10, 15 years before people even sort of really start hooking into it. So, you know, it's good to talk about it, to get it back out there, for sure, because it's a masterpiece.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
oh,
Jack
Nicholson. Go ahead, Pat,
and then I'll say what I was going to say.
Well, I was just going to say, the one thing we haven't even talked about is that insane, impossible final shot of the film. I figured out how they did it this time. I was really kind of zoned in. But for the longest time,
very long
for years
page.
And years and years, I had no clue how they pulled that off. Because you start in a room, and you just slowly track forward towards a window that has bars on it. You go through the bars, and then you go back around, and you face back into the room, and the bars are still there. So it's like you've magically, your spirit has somehow gone through these bars, and it's an amazing, amazing shot. It's like one of the greatest shots in all of film history, and I just love it.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that after just coming off of his Oscar, you know, with Cuckoo's Nest, I mean, so Nicholson was hot the whole time in that period. He had done Easy Rider, you know, a couple of the 60s sort of counterculture films, that sort of thing. And then he had done Five Easy Pieces, which is one of my personal favorite films of all time. I think 70, 71. And then, you know, had done Cuckoo's Nest and then this movie eventually. And it's funny because you're right about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. It wasn't a critical, successful film either. But Sam Peckinpah is such a popular director that a lot of his films have stayed intact with physical media. And unfortunately, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is one that is not really accessible. You know, I mean, you could stream it maybe, I think, but as far as a Blu-ray, I don't think there is one. And I really hope that there is someday because I love that movie and it's Bob Dylan's in it, Chris Christopherson. But what's interesting, too, is that Jack Nicholson would also go on to do the Missouri Breaks with Brando, and that film didn't do very well either. I don't know who the production company was behind that, but that film has also gotten a Blu-ray through Kino Lorber, which I own, and I like that film. I mean, it's not great, but I love Brando and I love Nicholson, and I think they're good together. But this film, you know, The Passenger, the Maria Schneider, you know, she was an actress who didn't do a whole lot either. She was just that girl from Tango in Paris. And then she had done a few other, you know, foreign films, that kind of thing. And in this film, The Passenger, even though she is sort of the love interest again, it's sort of that Brando kind of romance. It's the dangerous thing that is the attraction that she goes with. So she's kind of, in a way, playing the same sort of free-spirited person. But I think she does that very well, you know. And it's just sad that the film, The Passenger, you know, is sort of lost to an audience as well. These other films are getting re-released for, like, the third time, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that's politics for you. But also, yeah, I mean, Jack Nicholson, not everything he touched at that point was gold. He was also in The Fortune that year, which was a big flop with Stockard Channing and Warren Beatty. And like you said, The Missouri Breaks in 76, Last Tycoon was not a big hit, Going South was not a big hit. The Shining, he kind of gets back into the game. But, you know, yeah, I mean, he was a hot property, but, you know, he, like I said, not everything he touched was gold. And I should also say, back to Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid just real quick, the reason that we even have the cuts that we do is due, in fact, to Jerry Harvey's Z Channel, which did the major restoration work of the Sam Peckinpah's original cut, or brought it back into the public consciousness after MGM had basically gotten rid of it. So that's kind of how that came about.
Yeah, and I think The Last Detail is also another great Nicholson performance. He personally feels, I think I've read or heard that Jack Nicholson thinks his best performance is The Last Detail. I could be wrong. But
I just have to interject here. We are the motherfucking Shore Patrol. Okay, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
So
yeah,
good.
So do I. We could talk about that movie forever, but we need to move on. So Patrick, you have a last choice for us?
Yes, I did save the best for last, and I knew I was going to choose this one. I chose 1955's Rififi by Jules Dassin, which I think is sort of the granddaddy of these types of films, and it is about a character named Tony, who is a who just got out of prison, and and his brother, he did some time for his brother, and so he's out of prison. His girlfriend has like gone off with a pimp, I think, and he wants to, you know, have one big score so he can sort of retire. And so they decide to hit this this jewelry store, hit the safe, and you know, rob it of its contents. And the thing about Refifi that's very famous is that, you know, in the middle of the movie, at the, I think, the 41-minute mark, there is no dialogue for 30 straight minutes. And in about 95% of that is completely silent, with the exception of the ambient noise of the heist. And the heist is what you watch the movie for. I mean, the movie is great. Everything about it is great. The performances are great. The cinematography is great. But the heist sequence is so influential, and it is so well done. It's like it's pure cinema. Because, I mean, it shows rather than tells. And you get every single step of the way and the meticulous details of cracking the safe and chopping through the ceiling and, you know, destabilizing the alarm. And I just adore that piece of filmmaking that's in the middle of the film. I love the whole film on the whole. But that piece of filmmaking, you know, every movie that has a tricky heist sequence, like Ocean's 11 or Thief, those come from Refifi. And it's so jaunty and well done. But I also love just how brutally tragic the movie is. And to tie it back to The Asphalt Jungle from a couple of weeks ago, they have almost the same ending. In a car. And so I sort of like that, you know, that was the last one I watched for the series. I watched it today. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot that was the ending of The Asphalt Jungle, too, with Sterling Hayden dying as he's driving the car. And, you know, he gets there and he dies. Refifi is just a classic. I cannot there's not enough superlatives for it. I need to upgrade my Criterion. I have the old Criterion DVD that's got the sticker still on it that says director approved Jules Dassin when he was still alive, because he lived to be a ripe old age. He didn't die until 2008. And a little bit about Jules Dassin is that he was a really great film noir director in America. He made Brute Force and Thieves Highway, I think, and then he did, in 1950, he makes Night in the City with Richard Widmark, and right when that movie is done, the production of it is done, he is informed that he's being blacklisted, and the movie gets taken away from him. He has no control over the final edit or anything like that, and so he goes off to Europe and is sort of unemployed. He does some ghostwriting, but he's unemployed, and he makes his first film in 1955 in Europe. It's Refifi, and it's in French. And it was a huge sensation at the Cannes Film Festival, and he won the Best Director award there. And he continued to work in France, and then I think he worked in Greece. But Refifi is just a tremendous movie, not to take anything away from Night in the City, Thieves Highway, or Brute Force. Those are all great movies, but Refifi is just an absolute stunner, and it's a masterpiece in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I saw that about a year ago. I rewatched it, and that heist sequence is the heist sequence of all heist sequences. I don't care 100%. What you see, you know, Mission Impossible. I don't care any of those. This is the heist sequence, and it is just amazing. And the whole idea that 30-minute segment, it's just silent. They just do it. And it is some of the most wonderfully visual information given to you. And you are on the edge of your seat. Seriously. Yeah, I mean, I was up pacing watching that. Seriously. And that's how good it is.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing about Jules Dassin, which I also have to mention, when we did the show last week on the Post Classics, I almost picked a film from him that is very underseen, and it was actually mentioned in an article that I posted today called Uptight, which is he did a blaxploitation film before blaxploitation. This is 1968. And basically, it is a remake of John Ford's The Informer. And it is a tremendous film, too. But really, he's one of the ones, and I also talked about Joseph Losey, who was also blacklisted and went to Europe and went to England. But luckily they did that, and we have films of theirs from that post period that we can look back at and see how good these directors were and how unfairly they were kicked out of the U.S. because of this hysteria. So yeah, definitely want to just say something again about the scene and that whole situation. So, Brian, we're going to take it over to you. Have you seen Rafifi and what do you think about it? Brian, are you with us? Yeah. Can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I got cut off. I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
I can hear you. I could hear you. So and then I couldn't hear Brian, and then I couldn't hear anybody. So I came back in.
Oh, good. I did the same thing. So, Brian, if you're listening, please try calling back in. We got raptured. That's what we like to call it here at Blog Talk Radio. We got raptured. So I actually, we have a little bit of time, and I can talk about what my last pick. And we're going to go back to France. And we're going to talk about a director that's not as well known as Melville, but he had a real impact. And his name is Henri Beigneur. And I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But he did a film in 1970, which is based on a David Goodis novel called The Burglar. And it's called La Cassée, or otherwise known in the English translation, The Burglars, starring Paul Belmondo and Omar Sharif, and also Diane Cannon. And basically the story is Jean-Paul Belmondo is a thief who is in Athens and is steals a bunch of emeralds, and Omar Sharif is this detective who is on the take and is basically trying to cut himself into the burglary with Belmondo. And it's a cat and mouse, and it's got some of the best, two of the best car chases ever. It also has an incredible death scene for somebody, which I will not divulge who. And it is a fantastic movie. And I'm just wondering, Patrick, if you happen to know this film at all.
I do not know this movie at all. I saw it as a choice of yours, and I don't know if I'd ever heard of it. So, but it sounds terrific, obviously. I'll have to seek this out. I love Jean-Paul Belmondo, obviously. He's always great. So, but yeah, sounds terrific.
And I'll tell you what, Omar Sharif is great in this too. And it's very cat and mouse. And of course we're coming up on Thanksgiving, and we were going to do a couple of food porn movies, but we didn't get a chance. But if you watch this movie, you get a nice scene in a Greek restaurant with he's talking to Belmondo and trying to pressure him while they're eating all this wonderful Greek food. It also has a death scene that was called by Peter Weir in Witness, and that's all I'll say. It is a tremendous film. I saw it on early HBO, and that ending scene stuck with me, that death scene. It's really something. And the car chases, everything about this movie is just wonderful. I can't say enough about it. It is very hard to find. However, I will say this. You can go to www.ok.ru, which is the Russian equivalent of YouTube, and it is semi-legal, and you can watch it there. And I recommend it highly. And Bernoulli was sort of a low-rent Melville. He was more of an action director, and he did a number of other films. But this is by far his best, and it is just wonderful. The only caveat I will have to say is that the Diane Cannon character is somewhat wasted, and of its time, it's a little misogynistic. So I do want to at least give that warning on this film. Other than that, you also have a score by Ennio Morricone, which is one of his best. The cinematography is wonderful. And as I said, as an action film and a car chase film, it's really, really good. So I recommend it highly. So does that sound good enough to put on your list of watching films?
Definitely.
Well, I don't think Brian has come back, unfortunately. So I want to at least give a nod to Brian, and I'll message him. But these things happen. But we're glad. Ah, he is back. Hold on. You are back. You're here.
Yes. Sorry. I don't know how that happened.
So did you hear me talking about The Burglars?
Yeah, I've never seen it, and I was about to give my response on Rafifi, but it's okay. I'm not sure what happened.
Well, no. Give your response right now. What do you is it something that you'd like to see, or?
Well, Rafifi I'd only seen one time, and I saw it on TCM, so I didn't even see the Blu-ray of it or the Criterion or, you know, whatever. But I love the film, and I do want to explore the filmography of that director. And The Burglars, no, I've never seen it, but it sounded great. I mean, who doesn't love Ennio Morricone? And that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, guys, sorry about the little hiccup we had there, but we're all back now. At this point, we're going to go into just a little bit of housekeeping. And all I can say is what we've got this week. Now, tomorrow, Miss Vicki Love is going to be joining us in the afternoon. We're actually going to be doing this at 6 p.m. EST, which is 3 p.m. her time. She's going to be very thankful for a list of wonderful sci-fi movies that she loves. And so we're going to do that. And on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, we have the films of Krzysztof Kieslowski, and that's part of Cathode Ray Mission, and that's Adam Ferenc. Then on Saturday in the afternoon, Rachel is back with Down That Rabbit Hole, and we'll be with TC, and we're going to start our Christmas countdown and playlist. So that's what we're going to do on Saturday. And that's all we basically have at this point. So again, we want to thank everyone for listening and wish everyone, and particularly my two guest panelists here, wish you all a really happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too, and to you, too, Brian. Everybody out there as well.
Absolutely.
Yes, to the world. The political conversations will be a hoot. I'm sure, for everyone out there with their families.
Absolutely. So at this point, we're just going to basically say good night, folks. So let's all say good night.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Good night.
Don't let the bed bugs bite.